5, drop the pilot. Back home, there was very little time to prepare for the pilot filming. Plans needed to be set. Things needed to be written. Schematics, details, hunker down, focus. Instead, I brooded over Bingo Bingaman still being off my grid and in the covenant of owls and cordwood. And while steeped in a mental quagmire of my own stink, I slipped into a puddle of my old missing genius. Bingo has a younger sister, Kelly, who is demonstrably wholesome yet easily corruptible when it's innocent on a level like letting your niece eat cake for breakfast. She also looks very similar to Bingo, save for Bingo's dyed turquoise hair. I can make this gag work. Much like my own self-crucifixions, my best ideas usually come at night, alone in my own prattling head. My brainstorm was to secretly bring Kelly down to Bisbee and parade her on my arm throughout all the night spots in Old Town, in a turquoise wig, as my new gal pal, Bongo Bingaman. Through sheer excitement and salesmanship, I convinced Kelly over the phone to leave North Dakota at once and come to Bisbee. She was as concerned for her sister as I was, and overlooked the fact that I was serious about announcing her to our small town as my new girlfriend. This is common with civilians thrust into the world of dark comedy. Certainly, I must be kidding about the funny part. Historic Old Bisbee is the center of town, as opposed to where we live in what is the equivalent of a suburb. Old Town has all the bars and the nightlife. Willie performs as well as bartends at the epicenter of it, St. Elmo's, and Bingo had now been adopted there amongst the heart of the scene. Bingo had spent so many years as the kooky half of Doug and Bingo that it was important that she realized a place of her own, out of any shadow I may have cast. She deserved to be the center of her own attention. It also created the perfect place to play out this prank. In the dark streets and bar lighting of Old Bisbee, Bongo Bingaman was a greased mirror's image of Bingo. Dressed in Bingo's abandoned costumes and the blue wig, people high-fived and hugged Bongo without a second glance. The Grand, the Copper Queen, the Stock Exchange, and finally even to Elmo's, Bingo and Willie's home bar. They weren't there, but I knew that in a short time the rumor mill would be running gangbusters to get the news back to Bingo. Within minutes, my phone rang. Is my sister in town? And in the morning, my Bongo had left me for her sister Bingo, being given the rundown and the tour of Bingo's new life with the High Plains Drifter. Shame, I kind of thought Bongo and I maybe could have had something there. The problem is that Bingo actually did think that. The goof backfired hard. In all the years that Bingo had fought mental illness, this was the first time her sister had witnessed a full-blown episode. Bingo slamming her head against a wall repeatedly, accusing her sister of coming here to steal her man. Only she couldn't tell her which man, because Bingo thought that Willie and I were the same person. Manic depression, I'm told, is a frustrating mess. The first month of what was set to be the perfect year was just ending, and everything that hadn't already collapsed was sporting obvious fissures in the foundations. Making desperation moves like towing Bingo's sister into town, even when veiled in humor with an honest and upright intention, were still distracting from my obligation of being prepared to film this pilot. But first, I had a commitment to be a host. It's what I'm good at, and people count on me for this, even when my heart and head were separately elsewhere. It wasn't just that hooker in Los Angeles I couldn't get it up for. I'd gone impotent for all the basic joys in life. The Super Bowl was fast approaching, and so much as I'd like to blame it on all the calamities that had begun the new year, the truth is the big game had lost as much allure as the NFL itself. The Super Bowl between the Carolina Panthers and the Denver Broncos in February of 2016 was easily one of the most forgettable Super Bowls of my lifetime. I only remember people siding with the Broncos because it'd be nice to see Peyton Manning finally get a ring. The game where everybody wants to give one guy a hug, but otherwise are not partisan or engaged. Still, the Super Bowl party ran out of control for days before and for days after. Nothing but a haze of cocktails and narcotics, spinning plates and serving platters, comedians and comedy shows in the funhouse in the backyard. The football game just became a marker of time. It's a damp and accurate knowledge when you're in the throes and pinnacles of ecstasy, yet at the same time hauntingly aware that tomorrow's cost will be equal, if not inflated. This is going to hurt when we wake up, so best to try to not go to sleep at all. 11 days it lasted. Then the wall is struck between welcome all my friends to the show that never ends without segue into get the fuck out of my house. I'm the perfect host until my barometer shrinks to a place where I believe we should all be rightfully killed for our own protection and I need to hide. What I call rehab might be misconstrued by the general public as some sort of facility, some sort of program. If I just called it downtime, it would send the wrong message. It would make it sound like I was ready and available to have soft and meaningful conversations one-on-one with people. A quiet convalescence. Not at all. It means get the fuck out of my house. Rehab usually begins a week after the Super Bowl when everyone disappears. Even a vague sobriety is easy to achieve when you don't have to talk to anyone face to face. 2016 was different. There would be no rehab. There was a television pilot to be filmed. Dirty Harry said that a man has to know his limitations. Trying to write, produce, and star in my own television pilot with no budget while ignoring the dissolution of an 11-year relationship seemed all well within my capabilities. Thanks, Adderall. Putting things off to the last minute isn't just my tendency, but sometimes a tactic born of necessity. I'll put together a set on the afternoon of the show. Any earlier and it will all get lost in the abyss of a moth-eaten memory. All my ideas for pre-production had been laid out months before, and while it seemed like all the pieces were tight as Legos, now I could barely recall what the pieces even were. I'd had ideas for locations, but hadn't done any legwork to secure them. I knew what we needed for props and wardrobe without considering if they'd be available in this isolated hideout town. For crew, we had all the funhouse flunkies and regulars, all equally unqualified and depleted from the festivities as I was. As I said, Johnny'd been talking to me about doing a project since we'd met more than 2 years previous. The project was an entertaining pastime to mentally construct over drinks, yet never felt like something that would ever come to be. More like two buddies fantasizing about some beach bar they'd one day open in Key West if they ever won the lotto. Never was the subject broached of the fact that I loathe being on camera, how I tend to freeze like a mannequin anytime I have to act, or the reality that I'm only comfortable, confident, quick, or funny when I'm drinking. That's fine for an hour on stage, but unsustainable over the course of full days of filming. These were the small details the production company should have been made aware of. That production company consisted of two people from each camp. Sam and Keenan, Johnny's right and left-hand men, to match my Brian Hennigan and Greg Chaley. The debt men came in from L.A. bouncing with optimism while I was quivering from unprescribed prescription amphetamines. Where I'd once imagined this whole affair running so fluidly and effortlessly, now only the gaping holes were at the forefront. I could see how things should look or play out on camera, but owned none of the nomenclature to communicate those ideas that were in my head. So we just started filming and we'd find out what needed fixing later when we hit the potholes. The first major problem came before the crew even arrived. Bingo had been looming around the funhouse late morning as we were prepping. There was nothing noticeably wrong with her other than the unclear technicalities of our separation. At some point, she shuffled off to our other house, the quiet house, her safe house, and into her closet. She came back less than an hour later. She'd changed out of her overalls and into an outfit garish by even her standards. Like a circus clown dressed for the Kentucky Derby. Beyond flamboyant, especially for that hour of the day. But what stood out even more was the vacant look on her face. Dead, confused eyes looking like she'd just woken up in the wrong apartment. When I asked her why the getup, she told me that the two women from the wardrobe department at the quiet house had bathed and dressed her to film her part in the show. This was bad. She was completely gone. I held on to her and explained gently that there was no wardrobe department and that there was not even a crew here yet. In short, that there were no two women. She stumbled and stuttered and tried to plead that they were real, but almost immediately I watched her face fall, and she knew the reality that she'd lost her mind again. The truth was far more terrifying than the hallucinations. She could describe them in vivid detail and the conversation they'd had, all while knowing they didn't exist. She fell apart in my arms. We got her sequestered into a safe place with a sober sitter, for lack of a better term, and we got back to production. But as soon as Bingo had a moment unwatched, she slipped off into the day and back off the grid. There was nothing to do but get back to work. The premise of the show was simple. Film the podcast in the funhouse and direct the conversation into filmed field pieces. Talk about police abuse and segue into a spoof of the show Cops, only circa 1955, with a humble talking police officer explaining how much it means to him to protect people and serve the community. Then he gets the call and overzealously responds to yank Rosa Parks off the front seat of a bus. We staged a hidden camera bit in a pawn shop. I'd be behind the counter, and when a customer came in to pawn, say, a guitar or a DVD player, I'd decline but offer him a deal to sign away any given constitutional right. The right to vote, the right to freedom of speech, you don't use it anyway. $20? We also wanted to show how easy it would be for a person with a history of mental illness to buy a gun. And we had the person. Bingo would buy the gun while exhibiting every possible warning sign that she should not be allowed to have one. Once the weapon was obtained, we'd cut to her in the desert, blasting shotgun shells into melons adorned with the faces of notable people who'd been shot by the insane. John Lennon, Ronald Reagan, Gabby Giffords, and so on. But like the pawn shop bit, it was all staged and clunky. We didn't have the time, personnel, or means to do these bits legit. The idea was to get faked versions funny enough to sell the show and then go back and do them for real. But fake did not beget funny, and the whole thing was dying as we filmed it. The bits I liked the best were the ones I didn't have to be in. I fucking hate being on camera. My favorite idea was called Bad News from a Celebrity. You need to dump your boyfriend or someone is going to get fired at work. You don't want to do it. Wouldn't they take the bad news better if it came from Drew Barrymore or Alec Baldwin? And the bad news would have to be real. Clear out your desk. Seriously. For obvious reasons, this is something we'd have to film later in L.A. Don't have a big stock of famous people ready to do cameos in Bisbee. But this would never get filmed. The footage that we did have that went back had to be uninspiring at best. The worst of it was me guiding the podcast chunks, the pivot point. All of the ancillary pieces were supposed to be based and segued from the Funhouse conversations. The natural banter, which was anything but natural. I was dull and stumbling, trying to make it all seem like normal conversation, while cameras rolled, stopping for cuts for batteries to be swapped out, or audio issues of dogs barking. And then you can go back into and repeat that free-flowing discussion as though it hadn't just taken place moments before. I get it. I'm a comedian. Stand-up comedy is difficult enough to do without feeling like a fraud, repeating the same bits night after night as though it's all off the top of your head. But the road provides a different audience every night. Trying to pull off take after take in front of people you know and make it seem natural is grueling. No fascinating or hilarious conversation kicks off spontaneously with someone yelling, "Quiet and rolling!" Especially when your guests are real people, not stand-up comics. It all sank into a forced dialogue that would never translate to film or be seen as entertainment. And the worst part was knowing that it was failing as I was doing it. My peripheral vision is usually my main point of focus, everywhere, all the time. If we're at dinner and you've gone back into that story where you tend to repeat the same point or punchline too often, and you begin to sense that I'm not listening, you're probably right. I'm looking over your shoulder at the waiter on his way back to the kitchen. You changed your order 3 times and asked unknowable questions about ingredients while explaining in unnecessary detail your intestinal disorder that requires that you know. I'm now looking at the waiter's face to see if he's going to piss in your scampi. I'm watching your wife quietly pick the mushrooms out of her appetizer, wondering if she hates being there. I'm keeping an eye on the time in case I need to refill the parking meter, and I'm thinking about when it's appropriate to step out for a cigarette. Again. This is not a disorder. Simply a fact that my concerns are numerous and generally lie outside and above whatever it is that you're saying to fill what would otherwise be a comfortable silence for me. But it becomes a problem in a situation like this where all I can fixate on are the faces of everybody that I believe, wrongly or not, that I am disappointing. The cameraman will not laugh at your same joke after the 5th take. He isn't even supposed to make any sound at all. But if you can make the crew laugh, you're nailing it. The cameraman doesn't laugh at all, nor does anyone else. You second-guess everything you're saying. You remind yourself that this isn't supposed to be the funny part. This is supposed to be the genuine banter, but it doesn't feel like that either. This is not stand-up comedy where the fuck-ups only add to the allure of a live performance. Maybe it could edit well, but that gives no comfort to the collapse I'm drowning in at the moment. You can only see regret in the eyes of your guests, real or not. You imagine that they're all secretly waiting for you to look away so they can check their watch. All I can read in every face is that they'd bet on the wrong pony. That a lifetime of feeling like a fraud was now not only being exposed, but being filmed as evidence. I had so hoped to impress. At the wrap, everybody spilled false, conciliatory, post-loss locker room jabber. I think we got some good stuff. We can fix it all in editing. We're going to make it look good. I've proven more than adept at lying to myself when it's necessary, but over time I've found that ignoring and forgetting in short order makes the lying part unessential. The crew left. Hennigan later sent me some rough footage. I'm awful and stilted. Trying is the only word to describe it, and we all know how painful it is to watch someone try to be funny. Word came back that Johnny watched some of the rough cut. His only words were, "We need to get a comedy editor." I put it in the past and forgot about it. This chaos of production ended like a car door slamming. It had been days of gears pouring smoke as everyone tried to find their mark, hit their beat, and break through the finish line tape on time. And then immediately everyone is gone, and you sit in a wasteland of empty glasses and landfills of refuse. The tumult replaced by the literal sound of a clock ticking and the mocking chirp of a bird. But somewhere there, I was finally comfortably alone. Chapter 6, No Call, No Show. Being alone is a complete fucking misery for me that I burrow into like a masochist. When the fluctuating tide of chumps, aardvarks, and random gate crashers coming in and out for football or podcasts finally dissipates, and I'm suddenly isolated with my own dire reflections, I rapidly become unhinged. By this time, I've usually made such a production out of my need to be left entirely unmolested that I can't walk it back and troll for company. The difference being that this time I am truly alone. For all the markers of what is called codependent in my relationship with Bingo, the truth is it had worked. At least for me. Maybe I was just in a dependent relationship. She was always there, even if she was staying at the quiet house. We were together, and now we're not. Bingo had come in and out as best she could during the filming, doing her best to help out, regardless of how ill-equipped she was, or that we were in guiding her. She was so incredibly lost, and her head was falling even deeper. She knew she was welcomed back, but the decision had to be her own. I wasn't going to push her. Whatever was going to transpire, we'd work together. We were bigger than the details. Yet the sheer anarchy of the pilot ordeal kept my mind off the fact that she wasn't there at night, wasn't available on the phone even. My head is a toddler that needs to be set in front of a television to keep it behaved and distracted from its own cancerous ramblings. Sitting alone in the funhouse, my mind was awash in black tar regret, haunted by grimacing jack-in-the-box reminders of every misstep and lapse in judgment that the festivities had allowed me to ignore. Drunk and sober have no clear distinction anymore, but nothing bleeds worse than 4:30 in the morning in either headspace. Younger versions of myself would probably be entertaining the idea of putting down the drink altogether. Those would have been the thoughts of a child. Now it was time to confront these issues as an adult, as a man. This cacophony of blather in my skull would no longer be sequestered inside my head. To neuter it and render it impotent, I would loudly vocalize all the chatter in my brain with the same voice that male comics use to imitate a bitchy lady. Yes, I'd dehumanize the voices in my head. I call it self-medicating. Give that thought a grating, nasally voice, and then thunderously shout it out loud before shouting it down. Give it life only so that it can be beaten down and murdered. For a man who needed distraction in a house desperate for a lift, there was no better news than to hear that my friend, comedian Bert Kreischer, had made a last-minute travel alteration to be able to visit us in Bisbee for the first time. No better man for the job. Bert is a whirlwind of high energy and snorting laughter. Constantly. It's impossible to be in a shitty mood around him. He comes into any room all beard and beer fat and draws sunshine out of the walls. He makes you smile without caring that you have bad teeth. He's like huffing cocaine and laughing gas, and he makes it all seem like it's your own doing, that it's you that's making him this funny. And if that's a trick, it works every time. Bert's travel plans only afforded him a night, and we drained it for every minute that we could. I remember when he walked through the door, Chad Shank and I were poring over some pills that we'd been given, but unable to remember what they were or who gave them to us. They didn't even have codes on them to do an internet search. But we were pretty sure they were uppers, and uppers were going to be handy. Kreischer was falling apart at the idea of us swallowing random pills on a hunch and a calculated risk. He was laughing so hard he couldn't speak. Sometimes you don't see your own behavior as anything unusual when you keep the outside world walled so far away. But it served to jumpstart Bert into immediate snot-slobbering laughter and, as usual, making it feel like somehow we were the life of the party. We ended that night barely able to walk and with the usual homoerotic overtones that I'm only aware of due to the internet footage floating about. Bert likes to film things for public consumption. Nobody would wake up anywhere near sober enough to drive Bert back to the airport in time for his early flight, so Bingo volunteered to come pick him up in the morning and take him. She drove him in our 1999 Chevy Tahoe with a 250,000 miles on it that I'd bought at a police auction. I bought it as a dog car, a beater that could get mud and fur on the seats and nobody'd give a fuck. Otherwise, I was afraid to drive it past the corner store. On the drive, Bingo opened up to Bert about everything that had happened and everything that was about to happen now. About her mental state, her confusion, and the paralyzing indecision on who she should be with. She'd packed a bunch of her things, she told him, left her phone behind, and wasn't coming back for a while. She needed to sort things out, clear her head. She didn't say where she was going and probably didn't know herself. She asked him not to say anything to me. She couldn't have believed that he wouldn't, and I don't think he told her any different. I doubt she'd made it out of the airport before my phone was ringing. And with that, I got my bad news from a celebrity. Bert Kreischer and I are as close as any two comedians who love and respect each other can be, regardless of the fact that we've probably only been in each other's physical company a dozen times or less. Don't mistake me, that can be and is pretty fucking close. That's a guy I could leave 50 grand in a sack while I went to prison and know not a nickel would be touched when I got out. I mean, I wouldn't count on him to visit, and despite his best intentions, the one letter he would write would be lousy with butt rape jokes. My point being that as close as we might be, Bert still should have never been put in that position, especially in the depths of a ruthless hangover. Thanks for the hospitality, Doug. I had a blast. By the way, your wife has decided to disappear into the ether, driving a moribund jalopy with no way to reach her without a clue in the world where she's going or if or when she'll be back. That's essentially what he told me. And this being such an incredulous ending to a chart-topping night, he couldn't deliver the news without squeals of laughter. Now I understand what it's like for a parent to turn around and find their child no longer beside them at the mall. Utter panic. A sense of disbelief that there's no quick remedy or simple bypass to turn this back around. I'd call her repeatedly, only to have her phone ring next to me at the funhouse bar where she'd left it. Like when you keep flipping on the light switch to find a flashlight in a blackout. To make matters worse, I'd found it funny to record her outgoing greeting. So now when I called, I'd just hear my own voice on her voicemail. Hi, this is Amy Bingo Bingaman. Please leave a message. Ugh. I'd run away from home as a child often enough to know the mantra of your parents upon finding you at the end of the street, saying that they want to scream at you and hug you all at the same time. They'd actually say beat the shit out of you, but that was a different day and age. I wanted to kick Bingo square up the shitter with a curly-toed genie shoe. We had a rule about disappearing like this with no means of contact. The rule was don't ever fucking do that. I have strong abandonment issues that may be control issues, and these apply even in minor events of her not being home close to when she was supposed to be home. This isn't about being a prick. She could leave for a weekend or a year anywhere in the world, but I need to know where you are and be able to be in touch. The hours leaked like the clock had an enlarged prostate as I waited for any kind of word. I called any and all of her friends and family, hoping they'd heard from her, but only serving to cause more widespread panic. It isn't just me who knows that Bingo at her best is still particularly vulnerable left to her own devices in the world. And soon Bingo's phone started ringing from other concerned parties. Buttercup was how Washtub Willie was listed in her phone, and the frequency of those calls left me no doubt as to who that might be. You can imagine how my stomach curled with disease every time I saw and dismissed that ring, especially after I'd jumped with some ill-thought hope that those calls might somehow be Bingo calling me on her own phone from her own phone. Eventually, my own phone started ringing from that same number, sans the moniker. part of me would be rolling my thumbs over one another like an evil madman, reveling in Willie's shared agony. But the messages he left were of heartfelt concern. I'm too old and aware to bask in the fuck that other guy kind of animosity. There was a common cause. There was a quota of cocktails necessary to straighten my posture enough to return the call. Some people are born with courage and stoicism. Others buy it triple filtered from a plastic jug. Kreischer had told me that Bingo said, half jokingly, that maybe Willie should come on the podcast and we could decide for her which one of us she should be with. It took an afternoon and several drinks before that sentence turned on a light bulb. You're goddamn right we should, Bingo. By the time I made contact, I'd already come to the sprightly conclusion that not only should Willie come to the funhouse, but that we should be recording from the first hello. This is sure to be good radio. Our podcast has never had any structure. There's no opening monologue or news of the day unless it comes in organically. The podcast started as a goof and turned into a vaguely larger goof. If it's genuine at all, it's that everyone involved is open in who they are. So the show has turned into somewhat of a soap opera, a cast of recurring guests who you can pretend to be in the room with, getting drunk and talking shit about your day. And on the rare occasion that a known entity like Bert Kreischer comes into the funhouse, you're as excited as we are, or as excited as you would be if he came into your apartment. But at its best, the podcast thrives when things turn grim or tragic. It can seem exploitative, and sometimes that's by design, turning tragedy into hilarity. And as much as I've done this to others on the podcast, I'd be hypocritical not to put myself in the crosshairs as well when my life turns ruinous. It's what we owe the listeners that we let into our lives. Steve Irwin, aka the Crocodile Hunter, was popular for fucking with dangerous animals in Australia. People watched, biting their cheeks, hoping against hope that he would get maimed or killed on any given episode. No differently than you watch a tightrope walker like a praying atheist anticipating a fall. Otherwise, you'd just be watching a guy walk real slow. Steve Irwin fell hard. A stingray's barb tore through his chest and popped his heart like an heirloom tomato, all on camera, making a million dreams come true for the viewers. But they decided to bury the footage, denying the masses who'd logged so many hours waiting for this magnificent reversal of fortune their day in the sun, cheated them blind with no recourse. What I'm saying is that there's an obligation to the audience. We don't cheat the listener when hearts explode and we are dead in the water like so much chum. I'm also aware that other people are not in the good radio business. While we thrive on using comedy to stomp down catastrophe, other people can see this as simple profiteering off someone else's bad beat. They aren't necessarily wrong, especially if they don't get that the humor is intended to be palliative, not to mock or diminish. This can go poorly in a small town setting. In October of 2013, our good friends Derek and Amy Ross, aka Nowhere Man and a Whiskey Girl, as they were known as musicians, died together in the same 24-hour period. She died that morning at 40 years old of a blood infection after years of fighting lupus. Derek took his own life at 39 later that evening. Some suspect that the two events were related. But here's the rub. Derek asked if I would pass on the news of Amy dying via her Facebook page. There was an entire town of Bisbee and a country well beyond that had been stoking the internet, championing her recovery. Masses of people were glued to Facebook as their only way to keep track of her progress. Derek and Amy were the king and queen, heart and soul and sound of Bisbee. For Derek, the idea of having to announce the bad news, much less handle the inevitable onslaught of sympathizers, was not something he could handle. I was more than happy to oblige. He gave me the login information, and I thought it best to write it in her first person and in keeping with her always smiling, upbeat ways. I wrote, "Hey kids, bad news. I died this morning and Derek didn't know how to tell you. I love you all and I hope you go out and be nice to someone. Funerals are a bore, so hopefully I don't have one. Give Derek some space. He stinks at this, so leave him be for now. Thanks for all the kindness. Please spread it around." It's not my best work, but my deadline was on a short layover at an airport. Derek read it and thought it was perfect, dark, funny, and certainly in her spirit. That's all that counted. It would be some time before I found out that many a folk took umbrage with my post. Outrage was alive in so many of their friends and fans who thought at first that I was fucking with them, and then second, that I was being horribly disrespectful and insensitive by what they considered making fun of such an awful turn of events. And by that point, Derek, who had been so desperate for me to make the announcement, had now blown his head off before he could even defend my honor and have my back. "You said this was a good idea, motherfucker. You couldn't have even left that in a note?" So to have Willie come into the funhouse to make entertainment out of a situation that in any other case would be adversarial, it could feel like a setup. And to broadcast, it would only be chucking gas on an already raging bonfire of town gossip. But it was a calculated risk made by a guy who stinks at math. Willie walked in like he was Eastwood, coming through the swinging half doors of an old West saloon. He wasn't concerned with the fact that we were recording. He didn't even know or care what a podcast meant. Willie likes to boast about the things he doesn't know. It takes one to know one. I couldn't name you two hit network sitcoms in the last 20 years, and I like to brag about it. Willie, living off the grid on a wasteland of high desert, could certainly one-up me on not knowing that kind of shit. But he was happy to be there to clear the air and to have a friend with a problem in common. This didn't make things much less awkward. The dialogue was muddy with pained pauses, me trying to vacillate between perfect host off the air to my smart fuck on the mic. Also, he scared the shit out of me. Not just physically. Most people give me the fear when it comes to fighting. I couldn't fight a strong breeze in the deep end of an above-ground pool. He intimidated me for all the reasons that I'd been goofing on him. He lived off the grid because he had the ability. I goofed on him for the outhouses in part because I was envious that he knew how to construct one and to comfortably keep owls in the top of it. I tend to fixate on and lament everything that I can't do, and he did all of them well. It humbled me, like dating a girl who rides a motorcycle or has to open a pickle jar for you. Sometimes what makes for good radio is just the willingness to put it out there. I think that if it was a series of perfectly timed lines and guffaws with conflict only in the setup but not in the bloody meat of it, it would only sound like one of those network sitcoms that I have no reference for. Good radio is reality television if it were all reality and zero editing. But artistic integrity aside, the goal was to find bingo. We put out APBs for the listeners with all the vehicle details, listeners who were spread wide across any direction she could be heading. Chaley made quick work to get the podcast out as soon as drunkenly possible. And in the morning, I woke up delirious and immediately called Bingo on the phone, only to hear my own stupid voice again. Willie and I traded calls of no news throughout the next day and decided, fuck it, let's do another podcast and keep doing them daily until she's located, or like that missing Malaysia flight until nobody cared to look anymore. This time we got along like old friends over whiskey, and there were moments where Bingo almost became an afterthought. And just as we were wrapping up the second podcast, my phone rang. due in a large part to my exemplary former career as a telemarketing master, I immediately spotted the 504 area code as New Orleans, one of the top places I suspected she might have gone. Bingo was found. War whoops went out, and she was all smiles and apologies via speakerphone. Impossible to hate, and blown away to find out that Willie and I were hanging out and had done not one but two podcasts together, just as she jokingly imagined. It was good radio. Chapter 7. Milking the Rat. The next day I was on a plane. I got to New Orleans and I found Bingo at a bar, which is exactly where I needed to be. We talked quite a bit, mostly because Bingo had found cocaine. We talked a shitload. We talked at and over each other talking. Very little of substance, but it was a positive start, and it kept going. Bars are open 24 hours in New Orleans, and we'd be damned if we didn't use them all. If we found common ground, it was on a jukebox, not in the unearthing of the recent past. If we came to any realizations, they were lost in a three-day tornado of blow and the heavy pour of the Big Easy. When it came time to leave, my head was muddy, and coordinating an exit strategy was rough work. The vehicle was something I was hesitant to drive to the post office, much less across half the country. I considered ditching it altogether and flying us both back, but she had so much shit in it that we'd need to drag a U-Haul from the tailgate of the plane. Eventually, it was decided that I'd fly back, and I'd fly Willie to New Orleans to do the drive with Bingo. Willie could make a coonskin hat into snakeskin boots. He could surely commandeer a hunk of shit Chevy Tahoe across 1,500 miles of barren highway. I'd made good with Willie, and it seemed, mind you, that Bingo and I might be back together. But when it took them more than a week to make their way home, stopping for days to visit with his relatives, I realized that things were as clouded as ever, more questions than answers. It was near mid-March when Bingo landed back in Bisbee, and the unaddressed limbo of the relationship had simply become exhausting. She bounced back and forth between Willie's and our house as though we were in fact the same person. She seemed to be with Willie for fulfillment and at my place for laundry, food, showering, and sometimes a place to sleep out of the cold. Sometimes all you can do is write about it, and my comedy notebook was filling up fast. Gossip was still running wild as it always does in this town, and because of this, I became the recipient of more than a few passive welfare checks. Someone would stop over unannounced but honestly concerned for me, and I'd assure them that I was fine over a cocktail or more, because that's the only way I find it tolerable to socialize with folks, especially when they come on so somber and mollifying. And as soon as one would leave, someone else would show up and take their place like they were taking shifts. And for days, I would drink with each one of them in an endless revolving door. Chinese water torture drinking. "Hey, I was really just worried about you. But seriously, if there's anything I can do, remember, if you need someone to talk to..." The only person I wanted to talk to was an audience. Trying to throw these bits I'd been writing into conversation only served to garner looks of sympathy. The head nodded to the side and the sad smile, as though these jokes were only there as a mask. Doug is hiding behind his humor as a coping mechanism. He uses his comedy to conceal his pain. "No, fucky, I use comedy as a tool, one that you don't have in your arsenal. You wouldn't understand because you're not funny. When you have humor, there's no need for spite or blame or retribution. The same can be said for alcohol. It can be used as a practical tool when it's in the hand of a skilled craftsman and used as directed. Creativity, courage, even pain if you know how and when to apply it." No doubt there was pain here. When I was but a young prepubescent, my horrible brother and his friend would torture me like a lab animal. One of their favorite tricks was called Milk the Rat. Look down at your thumbnail. You'll notice the white half moon at the base. This is a very vulnerable part of your body. Now take your stronger thumbnail and press it into that white spot as hard as you can until you feel the worst imaginable pain you've ever felt. At this point, you should stop doing that. You have accomplished Milk the Rat. That's equivalent to some of the emotional pain that I felt at this moment, when I was again without distraction. Humor isn't going to help you from Milk the Rat pain, but it's almost essential for emotional pain. Humor isn't something you use to hide from it. It's something you find within it. It isn't a useless defense mechanism like denial. It's a pile of meat that you sit in front of like a butcher, and you start to carve off the fat and gristle and get to the good stuff. Find the jokes. I found the opportunity to do a show in Bisbee, something I rarely do. Don't shit where you eat. Like the cruise ship, you don't want to suck in front of people you're going to have to see every day at the grocery store. And Bisbee is far smaller than the population of that cruise ship. But this show seemed necessary. With all of the scuttlebutt that had been passed back and forth in town, it almost felt like a press conference, an official statement of sorts. And it killed, and it felt good. Everything you want from stand-up. I left nothing out of it. I also, in turn, drank myself sick between the show and trying to keep up with the slow parade of well-wishers. I was bedridden for days. There was a night I sweat through 5 separate sets of clothes in one night. Peel off a t-shirt as wet as if you'd come out of a pool, slap it to the floor and put on another while you quake from the cold. And somehow this feels healthy, detoxifying even. At the same time, Bingo's health was declining even more rapidly in a completely different way. If Bingo hadn't admitted herself to the Bumble Hatch voluntarily, I might have organized a team to break her out. There seems to be no difference in your treatment or care in a mental health facility whether you go in on your own or are dragged in screaming in restraints. From the moment she'd agreed to be institutionalized, she was a prisoner. She'd come back from New Orleans with her head as clear as ever. Calm, sober, reasonable. We planned to talk everything through and make some decisions as to where we were going. We'd intended to do this right after she was done with her regularly scheduled appointment for her psych visit, but she didn't come back. During her session, she told them about her mind slipping and made the mistake of saying the word suicide. This labeled her immediately and without context as a danger to herself and others. She could be admitted voluntarily or she could go the hard way. Either way, she wasn't going to make it back for dinner. Bingo was painfully aware that the level of care she could expect locally was dangerously inadequate. She was held in the ER at the hospital in Bisbee while waiting for a bed to open at any number of psych facilities in the state, and she hoped for one as far away as possible. When a bed was found in Phoenix, she was relieved. An ambulance came to drive her the 3.5 hours to Valley Hospital, where she'd be staying indefinitely. I wasn't allowed to drive her myself, but I was fortunate enough to have one of the EMTs recognize me when she was being loaded up. He'd break the rules for me and allow her to ride unrestrained and be able to use her cell phone along the drive. This is mental health care. You need to know somebody in order to be treated like a human being. I might have worried about Bingo being on her own on the outside, but I was surprised to see how well she could hold her own on the inside. From the beginning, she was stoic and resigned. Even when the conditions at Valley Hospital proved to be as pitiful as she'd ever been through. They wouldn't even let her make a phone call for the first 24 hours to let me know that she'd been safely admitted. She was housed with addicts who were violent. jailhouse scrubs and paper shoes. It was 3 days before she was allowed crayons. On that first call, she said that she just wanted a cigarette, which, as in jail, was a currency that the inmates were loath to part with. I took to Twitter and asked anyone in the area if they could drop off a pack. Cartons came in. I asked people to send postcards and letters. The staff told her they'd never seen so much mail in all their time there. She even found yet another Stanhope fan on the staff. She told me it was the first time in a week she had a conversation with someone who didn't try to drink soap. She was put into a room with a maniacal fullback of a woman who greeted her with, "I don't want no motherfucking roommate!" and would shout Bible passages continuously throughout the night. Eventually, little Bingo had enough and got in that woman's face. Bingo dressed her down, told her that they were both in the same shitty position, and to leave her the fuck alone, fully expecting it to go to blows. She put that pit bull in a corner and told it to sit, and it sat, even whimpered a bit. Handled, sorted, fucking baller. When I told Johnny about her situation, he offered to fly out in a helicopter and cause a global ruckus. There's no way that you don't appreciate the sentiment, but I told him that it wasn't necessary. Bingo would end up spending 9 days in the banana factory without ever seeing a doctor for more than basically a head count. The only treatment she received was arts and crafts. Bracelets and charades were mandatory therapy sessions. Mandatory. And then suddenly they decided that she was cleared to go. Most likely they found a better source of revenue for that bed than the state could provide. Or maybe she was just that devastating at charades. She was released on March 25th, my 49th birthday. I wasn't there. I was drunk and sideways in Daytona. There was no round-trip fare covered for Bingo's ambulance ride. When she was sprung on short notice, I offered to fly her out to Florida. I thought it would be funny to fly her first class, still wearing the paper slippers and smock marked Valley Hospital as an advertisement for their slipshod treatment of patients. She declined. Instead, Washtub Willie and his entire family were there to pick her up at the gate. She said she needed this time to let Willie know that she decided that she and I would be staying together. Chapter 8, Daytona. I hadn't been on the road in 6 months, and although Daytona wasn't my gig, I knew that I'd have to become involved. Andy Andrus, Junior Stopka, and Sean Rouse were three of the funniest comedians I'd ever watched, and without question, amongst the biggest fuck-ups of all time. I'd taken all of them on the road with me over the years, but just one at a time. Just one as a full-time job of wrangling. The idea that they were touring together now without any supervision or level head was absurd. Together, they were a traveling blackout crime scene and possibly the greatest show on earth. I had to witness it. And I did. But just like a drunkard's version of attorney-client privilege, I couldn't tell you anything that happened that weekend. I boarded the plane in Tucson after several early morning cocktails and kept them coming on the plane, along with the appropriate dosage of downers to sleep, which I stayed awake and kept drinking through. These are the flights where you wake up at your destination wondering how you could have possibly navigated your layover, much less found your hotel upon landing. I woke up having no idea where I was whatsoever. There was a note left on my nightstand from Chaley, resting on a box of Lifesavers gummies. It read simply, "You are in Daytona Beach. You're in room 621. We are in 418. I snapped a picture of that note, probably to remind me of how much Chaley can read me and is prepared for me, to remind me that I should probably thank him more often for looking out for me. That's what I assume, But I didn't find that picture until I started writing this book years later. Secure in the knowledge of my location, reason for being there, and the fact that I had zero obligation or responsibility, I went directly to the hotel bar and began drinking again. This kind of drinking might be called vacation drinking or birthday drinking. For me, it was both, although my birthday was incidental. But still, it's the kind of consumption that idiots are fond of when it's New Year's or Mardi Gras or even your birthday if you're an idiot or a kid. You drink to an extent where you're guaranteed to forget everything that you'd spent all this time and money to be present for, to witness. I wasn't alone. I don't know that anybody retains two cogent memories of that long weekend, despite the fact that we recorded 16 different podcasts during those few days. I sat through all of them during the writing of this book to see if they stoked any memories. They didn't, and they are unlistenable. But they seem to show that I was on the kinder end of fucked out of my mind. I'd only dabbled in acid and some coke during my drinking binge there. I hadn't accidentally done meth or heroin or been ripped off on drug deals or been involved in any physical altercations. From what I can find from the permanent record, I was merely relentlessly annoying. Junior Stopka I don't see often enough. This stringy-haired, lummox Polish kid with his absurd humor and his antiquated sense of manners, even in the depths of his bottle. We've had him on the road with us often, except in the summer. You see, Junior is reluctant to shower and has a fear of deodorant when he's the person who needs it most. Like Dracula being afraid of blood. In the summer, packed into a tour van, well, Junior, we went in a different direction. Andy's stories only get more rich and layered the more he continues on the odd adventure that is his life. He's been to the darkest places in his life by choice or by circumstance or by sheer nitwittery, and always turns it into fodder for everyone else's highest amusement. But Andy on the road requires a specific mindset. Those stories of his are going to continue in real time, and you have to be prepared to troubleshoot the fallout. Sean Rouse was and is one of the most incredible comedians I've ever watched on stage. We'd been friends since the mid-90s, and we shared quite a bit. But his own struggles, both physically as well as the addictions, were beyond anything that were manageable on a daily basis, much less on tour. He was the main reason that I came to Daytona. Sean's afflictions had kept him from working much at all, so I never knew when I'd be able to see him live again. And Daytona would be the last time I'd ever see him alive. Shawnee was an elderly child of 43 when he died in 2018 of a heart attack following a stroke, with a long period in the hospital in between. I was mortified that I hadn't even been informed of the stroke. And when I said this out loud, Andy was there to remind me. Months earlier that year, on stage in Ocean Beach, California, my cell phone rang in my pocket. I stopped my show, looked at the number, and it was Rouse. I announced this to the audience and took the call, figuring we could mine some hilarity via speakerphone. "Hey, Dougie. I'm in the hospital. I had a fucking stroke." "Okay then, well, you're on stage in San Diego right now, but I thought this might go funnier. Let me call you after the show." I forgot about that call, and I forgot to call him back. I forgot he had a stroke, and I was terrified that it was Andy, of all people, who was there to sort out the facts for me. We all have our strengths. They say that history is written by the winners, but I'd counter that the drunks have a strong hand in doing the rewrites. Chapter 9, The Heart of Denial. People around me die. It's part of the lifestyle and it's part of this career. With this kind of longevity and a life on the road, you end up knowing an incredible amount of people. Too many to remember, even when they die. And on top of the sheer numbers, The fact is that the performer tends to perish far younger than the audience. The ticket buyers die way later. Ours keel over all around us, it seems. I had one somewhat insignificant story that I wanted to fact-check for this book. The timeline didn't seem to sync up. And then I realized that all three people I could call to verify it were already dead. You don't get used to it, but you stop being surprised. You just wonder who's next and when it's gonna be you. As I look back over the last decade, I can map benders that have run on seemingly years without reprieve. Like boxing matches in the olden days that went over 100 rounds or more. Doesn't seem possible now. 5 days in Daytona didn't look like any type of behavior that anyone could survive on a regular basis, regardless of the fact that we'd been training for our whole lives. And for 2016, Daytona would just be a sparring match. This total lack of sobriety, self-control, and social decency that was ever escalating wasn't a task that was without consequence. I tend to celebrate it, but that's somewhat dishonest. I use terms like regret and shame with a wink and a nod, but the truth is that the pain, disorientation, and stark reality of my own mortality and moral shortcomings only become more internal rug burn that tends to callus thicker every day. I fancy myself to be the puppeteer of my own addictions, as though I'm in control of them, if only because my life goes along seemingly unaffected. What some people would call functional. The obvious truth is that this circus doesn't function without a strong outfit of carnies, a term I use with reverence. For every carny, there's an ocean of midway marks, suckers waiting to wager their money on a show. We are, as I have said, wonderfully codependent. P.T. Barnum is not worth a shit without the lions and the lambs, much less the trainers and the tamers, the ticket takers and the geek acts, the tent pitchers and the 24-hour man. The bearded lady on the marquee depends on the crew as much as the crew depends on the marks. None of this small miracle of what we have built could have been done without a vast amount of support. We'd built a core group over the years, each one of us with strengths that molded into another's weakness. From there, it would spiral outward. In a corporate landscape, you might spin it as team building, but for us, it's just been a matter of finding each other at the bottom of the barrel. Somehow over the years, we've come together and found a way of fitting in with each other like a lava lamp game of molten Tetris. And in doing so, we've created something far more reliable and authentic than what other people revere in the trivia of what they call family. I wouldn't even cheapen ours with the moniker of dysfunctional. Even the quirkiest parts of our circle make it function at a higher level still. This at a time when I had no actual immediate family left to speak of. At some point that summer, my brother, who I loved dearly, took exception to something he'd heard I said from a source we both knew to be beyond suspect. He never asked me for my side of the story, and I don't know that I offered it. The simple fact that he might turn against me without questioning the validity of the matter was enough. Trust is the paramount precondition that fuels this unlikely machine. When it's in doubt, you simply